Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, January 8th, 2019, and this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news and culture magazine. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. On today's show, we look at some of the local impacts of the partial government shutdown and a new state law that's organizing community advocates around air quality. We also learn about Fresno poet Lee Herrick's new book and catch up with KQED reporter Alex Hall about her reporting on high-profile crimes involving immigrants to the Valley.
But let's begin by talking about college. It's the time of year when high school seniors flood universities with entrance applications and personal statements. Most deadlines have passed, but a few are still looming.
And for some seniors in the San Joaquin Valley, their immigration status has made applying for college tricky. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez has the story of two of these students whose names we agreed to change to protect their identities.
Shortly after Donald Trump was sworn in as president, an undocumented high schooler in Delano received a text from her parents. It was a photo of immigration and customs enforcement agents in their town. Her parents were on their way to work.
And they turned back and we stayed in for the house. We didn't go out. I didn't go to school for a week. It's just a constant, like, living of fear. And it's like, I don't think anybody should have to go through that.
That moment marked the beginning of sleepless nights and constant worry for Priscilla Garcia, a 17-year-old who goes to Robert F. Kennedy High School. Her parents are field workers and also undocumented.
Anywhere I would go, it's like, no, we should just go back home. Like, no, I really don't need that notebook for school. Like, no, it can wait, it can wait. And it's like, I never saw me living in fear like that. Like, just because, you know, a piece of paper.
Garcia was able to qualify for DACA. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Still, she says, she would freak out every time she saw a van while walking to school, or someone wearing a green uniform with a badge she didn't recognize. She says she felt trapped.
Every time I would get home and like I would knock the door and they wouldn't answer, like, I would panic so much. Like, oh my God, like, will they open the door? Like, will they be there when I get home?
The increased emphasis on undocumented people in Delano made her rethink applying for college.
It'd be so stressful because it's like everybody would be so ahead of their applications. It would run so smooth, and I'd be left behind. And like, it kind of made me feel like I didn't know who I was for a second. I was very lost, and I was like, I don't know, is this even worth it?
She needed lots of help on the form she had to fill out because she isn't a citizen. But even though Garcia says she felt alone, she knew others in Delano were in her situation too.
I can't believe a piece of paper really defines my status or really puts boundaries and borders in front of me. And I even contemplated, should I even be applying?
That's Marco Ayon. He's a senior at Delano High School. He says his biggest concern was how to pay for college. Undocumented people can't get federal aid. But luckily, he had a good counselor.
She just really gave me at least an inch thick packet that has a bunch of scholarships just for undocumented. So she was really on top of the game. She really helped me out in a lot of aspects of it.
Even applying for a driver's license made him paranoid. Under California state law, undocumented people can get a driver's license, but he still needed to provide proof of identity and residency.
I was eventually filling out some paperwork in the computer and I just came to realization that once those paperwork go to Sacramento, anything could happen from there. We might have those people out there in the door, eyes coming back to me.
Ayon deleted everything he filled out and walked out of the DMV. He says the risk of the government knowing his information just wasn't worth it.
I was just lost because I came to a realization that I'm limited to doing so many things. From the beginning of my career, college applications, to simply as getting a driver's license. It was just one of those moments that made me realize I'm not going to say I wasn't normal, but this is difficult. This is difficult times.
Adelaida Ramos is the assistant superintendent for Delano Joint Union High School District. She says school counselors are there for students, and the migrant education program can help students and parents. But even then, families are sometimes uneasy about sharing personal information because they aren't citizens. And kids like Ayon have a lot of anxiety because of ICE's presence in their town, especially after reports earlier this year of a Delano couple who died in a car crash while escaping ICE agents.
Ever since that incident, it kind of made me realize that it could happen to anybody. It's just real life.
Valerie Gorospe is a community organizer at the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment in Delano. She says no kid should have to endure what Ayon and Garcia are experiencing.
Everyone says that, right? Oh, kids are living in fear, families are living in fear. And it's almost like sometimes it doesn't have any weight, that statement that people are living in fear. But it's more than living in fear. Like this is their identity. This is how they are. This is coping strategies that they never had to learn how to do.
Gorospe often meets with Ayon, Garcia, and other students at the center. She says some students don't even talk to their parents about their struggles because they don't want to stress them out more. But Garcia and Ayon didn't let their status stop them from their goals. They both applied to various schools in the state, and Garcia says she's starting to overcome her biggest hurdle.
It was the biggest challenge I've had in life, like accepting myself, you know, saying like, oh, I'm undocumented and not be afraid. But I still live in fear sometimes, but it doesn't like define me. Like a paper doesn't define me.
But that paper will still be the one thing that limits thousands of kids and adults in the San Joaquin Valley. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
January is also the time of year when air pollution can spike in the valley, especially when the weather's cold, without wind or rain. When it comes to air quality, we typically turn to air regulators, like the state and the local San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. But a recent state law is taking on a new strategy, putting air quality in the hands of the community. And one person who's excited about the opportunity is Southeast Fresno resident Lilia Becerril. Becerril lives near the Fresno Fairgrounds and Vang Pao Elementary School. She likes it here, and she's a kind of career volunteer, working with local schools and groups giving legal aid and tutoring services. And so when she volunteered as a crossing guard a few years ago, it pained her to stop after just 3 weeks.
Mi garganta se contaminó o se dañó.
My throat was hurting, she says, because so many cars were passing by and idling. But it's likely more than that, too. As we speak, she points out a dark, smoky cloud hovering a few blocks away.
Sí, ¿qué es eso?
No sé. Es lo que les digo, que todo el tiempo hay humo donde quiera, sale que humo para allá, humo para acá.
I ask her what it is. She says, I don't know, but there's smoke coming from everywhere, all the time, and we don't know how we're here breathing. You see, just a few blocks from Becerril's home is heavy industry. Food distributors, warehouses, and lumber yards served by 18-wheelers and freight trains.
Cuando los aires vuelan para diferentes partes, todo viene a dar a las residencias.
When the wind blows from different directions, she says, it all comes toward homes. She wishes she could know more about her air quality, so she's gotten involved in improving it. As part of a new state law focusing on community air quality, South Central Fresno was selected as a priority area. And Becerril is on the steering committee, helping guide what happens here.
Porque queremos ser escuchadas y queremos que sea positivamente para todos y beneficio para todos.
We want to be heard, she says, and we want this to be beneficial for everyone, not just certain communities. We know that air quality can vary from place to place, even within our valley. But with only 38 air monitors among 10,000 square miles, air regulators are likely to miss local trends. For instance, we have an idea how many heavy-duty trucks traverse the state. But where do they bypass highways and release their exhaust in neighborhoods? Enter AB 617. Like Becerril, the author, Los Angeles County Assemblywoman Christina Garcia, also felt her community was being overlooked by regional policies.
We were forgetting communities like mine, and communities like mine have been left behind all my life.
And so the law empowers residents by selecting 10 focus communities across the state and establishing local steering committees. And with it comes $15 million for grants to build air monitors and bolster community outreach. The idea is, with more data on local emissions, a galvanized community can hopefully guide air regulators in cleanup efforts. Dave Warner is with the Valley Air District. Before AB 617, Warner says the district was primarily focused regionally. It also puts together an inventory of polluting industries and vehicles.
We know what's coming out of those pieces of equipment, but are there other things that we're not aware of that we're not controlling? This will be a fantastic way to find out.
AB 617 could be a change of pace for an air district that's been criticized for a lack of transparency. At a kickoff meeting in December, Fresno Steering Committee members complained the air district doesn't educate the public enough on air pollution and its health impacts. In a letter, the air district also sent the wrong meeting date to Spanish-speaking residents, though it later corrected the mistake. South Central Fresno and the Kern County city of Shafter are among the communities selected as the law's first priorities. Veronica Eady does environmental justice work at the California Air Resources Board, and she says the state knew it was critical to select regions with disadvantaged communities.
I'm sure that we're all aware that, you know, the most noxious land uses tend to be in disenfranchised, low-income communities and communities of color.
Ivanka Saunders is with the nonprofit advocacy group, the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability. She's hopeful this law will allow these communities to change their own circumstances.
AB 617 as a law is basically an evolution of a civil rights moment. That's how I look at this personally.
The Leadership Council and other Valley advocacy groups were awarded nearly $2 million in grants through AB 617. Though Saunders is optimistic, she says AB 617's Fresno region doesn't include an area of southwest Fresno that consistently ranks as the most environmentally burdened in the entire state. It's Saunders' hope that the steering committee will vote to expand and include that neighborhood. Whether or not it does, Lilia Becerril is excited about representing her southeast neighborhood on the committee.
Yo soy la voz de mi comunidad y yo estoy diciendo lo que mi comunidad me está diciendo.
I'm the voice of my community, she says, sharing what my community is telling me. Maybe soon, Becerril can shake the name she's given her neighborhood, the Black Circle. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
While the state is experiencing a transition of power and new laws for the new year, lawmakers in D.C. still haven't made progress on how to reopen the federal government. That means national parks like Sequoia and Kings Canyon are currently closed, but the more popular park in our area, Yosemite, is still entertaining guests. But there are caveats, including limited resources and staffing. No one is at the ranger station handing out maps, and outdoor bathrooms along the trails are closed. None of that deterred Katie Arnst. I found her standing in front of Half Dome last week, trying to get the perfect shot. She's a photographer from Sacramento who came here spontaneously.
This is my second day. Got here yesterday.
Arnst says she didn't see the trash and human waste that rangers have been posting about anonymously on Facebook. But maybe she just timed her visit well. The Fresno Bee reported that some have visited the park with the sole purpose of helping to pick up piled trash. But Arnst is a smart traveler, so she took some precautions.
You know, I definitely did a little more research. Brought my own toilet paper. I just researching what roads were closed, if a main highway I was going to take was closed.
Arnst didn't run into any closed roads herself, but park officials are turning away day visitors from the Highway 41 South entrance. Only guests with overnight lodging in the park can go through.
I mean, we came yesterday to, like, the other gate, and then they told us, like, that we had to come in through this other gate, which was, like, another, I think, hour drive.
Tyler Birch tried to enter Yosemite from the south entrance, but since he wasn't planning to stay overnight in the park, he got sent back through Oakhurst and Mariposa to another gate at Highway 140.
So then we just stayed in Oakhurst for, like, a while. I mean, for yesterday, and then we just came today instead.
It's not just Birch who spent more time in Oakhurst due to the shutdown. One restaurant owner says he's seen a lot more visitors than usual.
We had hour and a half waits. We had reservation bookings that I had to turn others away because I had tables reserved, or I had meals reserved that they were going to carry out.
That's Robbie Fleener. He and his wife have run Sugar Pine Pizza in Oakhurst for 9 years. He says the uptick in business could be from furloughed employees coming down for a meal and visitors who are taking advantage of the free park entrance. At the same time, though, Fleener says he feels bad for those who are struggling because of the shutdown.
I would love to take money out of my own account and help pay down the deficit, but I would want something in writing that when they do this or come anywhere near this again, they get spanked, just like a little child.
That's unlikely to happen, but it is true that the lack of services is keeping people, including children, away from the park. Jim Romo is one of them. He would have liked to take his grandkids, but it just seemed too complicated.
And I understand that many of the public facilities were not going to be available, so you'd have to be going into the hotels or perhaps some restaurants in the area. So we just thought that it would be a little bit too much trouble this time around.
Right now, hotels, stores, and restaurants in Yosemite Valley, which aren't operated by the government, are still open. At the same time, the Park Service will begin using entrance fees to fund basic operations. And that means Yosemite will continue to have visitors. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
And now we turn to the Mexican border. Thousands of migrants have been gathering in Tijuana, hoping for asylum in the U.S. Some will be deported or choose to go home. Some will wait in detention centers for hearings. And some will be allowed to live in California while their cases wind through the system. But making a life here is expensive. Even so, California asylum seekers here have certain advantages. As part of the statewide California Dream Collaboration, KPCC's David Wagner introduces us to one family that just arrived.
Rosa left El Salvador, she says, to get her family away from gang violence. She had a picture in her head of Los Angeles.
Lujosa, muy bonita.
Luxurious, beautiful. Some areas are like that, she says, but her corner of LA feels familiar.
A veces siento aquello como que yo estuviera en la capital del Salvador.
She sometimes feels like she's in the capital of El Salvador. We're only using Rosa's first name because her asylum case is ongoing. She was surprised by how expensive housing is here. For the first month, she and her two kids lived in cramped quarters with another family.
Donde ellos viven es bien pequeño.
She says the place was very small. They couldn't even access the bathroom at night. Since then, she's found a studio apartment near downtown LA. But supporting her family will be a struggle. Asylum seekers can't get a work permit until at least 6 months into their case. Many work under the table to get by. Still, Rosa says California has what she needs, safety, and the chance of a better life for her kids.
Aquí hay una oportunidad.
She says there's opportunity here and lawyers willing to help. Asylum advocates say California's legal community has really stepped up in recent years. The data shows those lawyers make a huge difference.
Finding a lawyer, we find throughout, is powerfully associated with positive outcomes in these cases.
UCLA law professor Ingrid Igley did a study that found families released from detention only won asylum 7% of the time when they didn't have a lawyer. Those who had a lawyer increased their odds of winning to 49%. That data only goes up to 2016. Lawyers say the odds are shrinking since President Trump took office. Even so, legal aid is still crucial for asylum seekers.
They're more likely to be able to gather evidence, to work collaboratively with their lawyer, and to otherwise prepare and find witnesses who can testify in their case.
Rosa's pro bono asylum lawyer, Patricia Ortiz at the Esperanza Immigrant Rights Project, says just being in larger California cities can give asylum seekers an edge.
In LA, perhaps more so than in other regions, I think the city and the county have made efforts to assist immigrants and refugees as best they can.
But for clients outside larger California cities,
it's next to impossible for them to get any kind of resources, and it's a very big struggle that we're always dealing with.
But staying in California can be hard. Jenna Gilbert at Human Rights First says it's heartbreaking to get calls from clients who say they're leaving months into their case because they just can't afford to stay. She tells them they're not just losing their lawyer. They're leaving behind California's more asylum-friendly Ninth Circuit.
If you move to a small town in Texas, housing is going to be much cheaper, but you probably won't have the legal resources, and you also will be in a circuit that is much less favorable to asylum seekers.
Rosa knows the judge in her case could decide to send her back to El Salvador, but she says she'd do well here if she's allowed to stay.
Soy una persona trabajadora, honrada y honesta.
She says she's hardworking, honorable, and honest, and just wants opportunity for her family, opportunity she wouldn't have in their home country. In Los Angeles, I'm David Wagner.
Stay tuned at the end of today's show for a second story by David Wagner.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. In the northern Central Valley County of Stanislaus, one of their local police officers was killed in the line of duty the day after Christmas. He was shot after pulling someone over for suspected drunk driving. And then the murder was followed by a manhunt to find the shooter, who traveled nearly the length of the San Joaquin Valley, and he was later arrested in Kern County. Alex Hall is a Central Valley reporter for our member station KQED. She's been following this story and is here in the studio with us. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been reporting on that police officer. His name is Ronil Singh. He was with Newman City Police, like I said, up in Stanislaus County. Can you talk a little bit more about what led to the shooting?
Yeah, absolutely. So Corporal Singh was working late at night, just after Christmas Day. So 1 a.m. December 26th in Newman, which is a small town about 40 minutes south of Modesto. He was alerted that there was a driver in a pickup truck who appeared to be drunk driving. He initiated a traffic stop, and then there was some sort of altercation. The next contact he had with anyone was when he called out shots fired over his radio. Officers responded to find him wounded on the ground. They later took him to a hospital where he died.
You've also done some reporting on the man who was arrested for this murder. His name is Gustavo Perez Arriaga. What do we know about him?
Right. So what we know from authorities is that Arriaga is 32 years old. He's from Mexico. He's been living here in the United States for several years. He's known to have worked on farms here in the Central Valley, including dairy farms. The name Gustavo Perez Arriaga is just one of several aliases he has used, according to his attorney. Arriaga himself told the judge at a hearing last week that his real name is actually Paulo Virgen Mendoza. Before authorities released his name, Stanislaus Sheriff Adam Christensen announced that Arriaga was living in the country illegally. And at that time, photos of him started circulating on social media with tattoos that appeared gang-related. Once he was ultimately arrested at the conclusion of this 55-hour manhunt, Sheriff Christensen announced that Arriaga did have known gang affiliation and two previous DUIs.
So murder charges have been filed against Arriaga, but the judge has put the case on hold. Why did that happen?
Yeah, so Arriaga's defense attorney said that after having a brief conversation with his client right before his arraignment last week, he had doubts about whether Arriaga was competent to stand trial. So the judge in this case suspended the case until Arriaga can undergo a mental health evaluation by a doctor. Apparently, this is something that happens a lot. In this case, it's going to take about 5 weeks. So we're expecting on February 7th, Arriaga will be back in court with other defendants who have been charged with accessory in this case. At that point, the doctor's report will be presented to the judge. And in the meantime, Arriaga will remain at the Stanislaus County Jail without bail.
And then you also reported that Stanislaus County Sheriff's Department, they're blaming the sanctuary state law that's only in California for this death. What exactly are they arguing here?
So immediately after this incident, or a couple days later, once Arriaga was arrested, Sheriff Christensen made it very clear that it's his position that California's sanctuary policies are to blame for Corporal Singh's death. As we know, sanctuary laws are the laws that limit cooperation between local police and sheriff's deputies and federal agents whose job it is to enforce the United States immigration laws, namely Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Sheriff Christensen said that given that Arriaga has this criminal history, that activity should have been reported to ICE. But because of sanctuary laws, local cops were prohibited from communicating with the agency. So in his theory, Arriaga was shielded from deportation because of those policies.
So this sounds really familiar to something that Tulare County Sheriff Mike Boudreaux said back in mid-December. I remember at that time, deputies had arrested an immigrant who was in the country legally, but he was arrested for being under the influence of a controlled substance. His name is Gustavo Garcia. He was in custody, but then released. And before he was released, however, ICE had asked Tulare County Sheriffs to continue detaining him. But Boudreaux said because of the sanctuary state law, he couldn't honor the detainer. So Garcia was released, and then soon after that, he went on to actually rob a gas station, commit a murder, and then led sheriff's deputies on a highway chase. He ultimately died from that car crash, from the chase. And so what I'm getting at is that Boudreaux was making the case that if the sanctuary state law wasn't in place, then the Tulare County Sheriff's Department could have complied with ICE and continued to detain Garcia, and then Garcia wouldn't have committed those crimes. So he's drawing a really straight line between how the law, in his words, didn't commit further crimes. Is that same argument relevant here?
Well, the reason why this is different is that in the case of Arriaga, there isn't clear evidence that sanctuary policies actually made a difference. The law that Sheriff Christensen has cited when he talks about sanctuary law in California is SB 54, the Values Act, which went into effect January 2018, 1 year ago this month. Arriaga was cited for DUIs in 2011 and 2014. So his interaction with police or sheriff's deputies or whatever law enforcement he had, the interactions that we know of took place before that law was passed and enacted. A spokesman for ICE said that local police never contacted them about Arriaga in those two instances. He also said that some counties can refrain from notifying ICE in an attempt to shield them from deportation. But I spoke with Kevin Johnson, who's the dean of the UC Davis School of Law. He said that given the laws that were in place at the time of those prior incidents or arrests, there were opportunities for law enforcement to share information with federal agents, and ICE could have picked Arriaga up at the time. The fact that they didn't, he thinks, is likely because, in the grand scheme of things, Arriaga wasn't a priority for ICE. Madera County was also not a sanctuary jurisdiction at the time, so he doesn't think that, you know, whatever agency it was, Chowchilla Police, Madera Sheriff's Department, he doesn't think that they would have refrained from contacting ICE in those instances.
Mm, and so the sanctuary state law maybe isn't applicable here.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Has the Trump administration weighed in on this crime or maybe either of these crimes that we've talked about?
Yeah, the president has weighed in. It's been reported that, you know, within, I believe, less than 2 hours after Sheriff Christensen announced that Arriaga was in the country illegally, this is before he was even named, President Trump tweeted about the manhunt, saying, he said, there is right now a full-scale manhunt going on in California for an illegal immigrant accused of shooting and killing a police officer during a traffic stop. Time to get tough on border security. Build the wall.
Wow. And what about other leaders, you know, those in the state of California or others locally? It sounds like, you know, for the Stanislaus County Sheriff and the Tulare County Sheriff, both sort of have these stances on the sanctuary state law. But are any of the more progressive leaders saying anything about it?
Well, here in California, it has definitely come up in conversation. You know, media will ask questions of other sheriffs in the Central Valley. First of all, outgoing Governor Jerry Brown, in an interview recently, he very, you know, directly said this has nothing to do with SB 54. It wouldn't have impacted the outcome at all, which isn't surprising. Very recently here in Fresno County, Fresno Sheriff Margaret Mims actually agreed with Brown and said that, you know, she thinks it's not fair in this case technically to blame SB 54 since it wasn't enacted at the time. But she does believe that it is possible that something like this could happen again with the current laws. And it's interesting timing because, you know, we have the government shutdown going on. The president's talking a lot about funding for a border wall. Tonight, he's planning to address the nation from the Oval Office, where he'll be talking about border security. He's also visiting the border on Thursday. It'll be interesting to see if this case comes up or the issue in general comes up in his remarks.
Yeah. And Valley Public Radio will be airing that address tonight with NPR analysis. We've been speaking with Alex Hall. She's the Central Valley reporter for KQED. You can hear her and her reporting more on the California Report, which we run every morning during Morning Edition. Alex, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
When we talk about healthcare, one of the most common complaints is the price tag. Monthly prescriptions that chip away at retirement savings, emergency procedures that can cause bankruptcy. With a new law that just went into effect this month, the federal government is trying to tackle at least some of the problem by requiring hospitals to be more transparent about their prices. But will it really keep us better informed? I spoke about this with Anthony Wright, executive director of the health consumer advocacy group, Health Access California.
Hospitals in California and now in the rest of the nation are required to post what is known as their charge master, which is their list of prices for all the services that they provide. What is good about this is that, you know, right now in much of the country, this is not information that is publicly available. What is less useful about this is that this is a very complex document of literally thousands of aid codes that are not very user-friendly, not very comparable, and so is mostly for use for people like analysts and academics more than the average layperson. That being said, we do hope that it starts a conversation that is desperately needed both here in California and nationally about the insanity of healthcare prices, whether they be at hospitals or other healthcare settings.
Right. So the regulation, requires hospitals around the country now to post these charge master files for the public, post them on their websites, make them very easily available. But it sounds like you're saying this is really not the step toward transparency that the federal government maybe was banking on.
Well, we don't want this to be an excuse for the increase in high deductible plans, health reimbursement accounts, shifting more costs and burden onto the consumers under the notion that because they're price conscious, they'll be able to do some of this comparison shopping, when in healthcare, there isn't not only the information, but also in many cases, the opportunity to make those decisions. We do need to have, you know, broader oversight and broader policies in place to try to deal with issues around cost and quality and efforts. And that's really some of the work that we've been doing here in California as steps beyond this price transparency to actually get at some consumer protections that protect people from high healthcare bills.
And so you've mentioned already kind of the difficulties of being able to take these numbers for what they are when they're posted in these charge master files. Insurance is a factor. There are a lot of different factors. I mean, why isn't it that we can just take these prices, you know, posted by these hospitals right at face value?
One of the reasons why this charge master data is of limited use is because it's not the price that it actually costs the hospital, nor is it the price that actually most anybody pays. In many cases, this is the sticker price, the sort of the price from which the hospital negotiates downward with health plan and other payers of health care. So in many cases, the actual price that a plan will pay for any given procedure is a third or a fourth of what is on these charge master lists and price. The problem is that there is a small percentage of people who do face these prices, who do get this full sticker price bill. That includes the uninsured, the underinsured, and people who find themselves with out-of-network or surprise medical bills. And that's where this information is important. This information also is important because even if this is not the price that most health plans or employers or union trusts pay, it is the beginning basis of the negotiation with those payers. And so it does give a window into why healthcare prices are so high.
Right. Healthcare is this unusual industry in the U.S. where prices actually are highly negotiable. But then, of course, confounding that is that it's not usually the consumer who's negotiating those. It's an entirely third party.
Right. And so that's why in California, we have taken steps to try to provide some greater assistance. It was totally unfair that people who were uninsured or underinsured, who had the least, were actually getting charged and expected to pay the most for hospital care. In some cases, 3, 4, 5 times what health plans were paying for the same service. And so in 2006, we passed the Hospital Fair Pricing Act that said that people should not have to pay more than the Medicare or Medicare rate if they are uninsured and under 3.5 times the poverty level. That is something that's California law, and that's something the federal government should also follow in California's footsteps. So, you know, it's important to take these steps for transparency, but it's also important to take additional steps to actually provide consumer protections against overcharging like California has done.
Right. And so this is a really good point, which is that the federal regulation that began on January 1st, 2019, this actually applies. I mean, it's federal, but it mostly makes a difference to other states, to not California, because we already have a lot of these laws on the books. And so here in California, these charge master files are already being reported by hospitals, right?
That's right. And the information that this new federal regulation requires is actually less comprehensive than what is required under existing California law. It's good that California has had these disclosures, but they should be seen as the first step in a longer conversation about the insanity of hospital pricing and healthcare pricing in America rather than as a solution in and of itself. And I think that that's what California has found it to be. It was a first attempt to try to start to deal with these hospital pricing issues, but we've had additional legislation since then to provide specific consumer protections and hope that that's the case for the country as a whole. And frankly, we need more continued reforms in California on this front. It can't stop at just transparency, especially since the prices that these charge masters have are just so inflated beyond what most payers pay.
And so what we have in California are a lot of consumer protections, not just the fact that these charge master files, these prices are available to the public. But for those who do, you know, maybe have the freedom or the liberty to be able to do some price comparisons, where can they find information about prices of procedures and devices, you know, at a hospital here in California?
They should be able to get the charge master from the hospital. They can request it from the hospital directly, or the new regulation does require it to be on the website. It is also available at the California Office of State Health Planning and Development. But I think for many people who are in the situation where they're seeing these charges directly because they're uninsured or underinsured, they should also be getting a notice that financial assistance is available, including a fair price as required by existing law. So if you do get a big bill in the mail from the hospital, it's one thing to check to see if they're charged based on their charge master. It's another thing to be able to talk with the billing office and say, hey, is there a discounted price rather than a sticker price that is the bill that I got? We have dealt with many people over the years who have gotten a huge hospital bill. In many cases, it's the biggest bill you'll ever get in your entire life. Some of them become experts in hospital billing because they are trying to deal with how do they deal with a $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 bill, you know, which could otherwise be financially debilitating for them and their family. And, you know, the best advice is to negotiate with the hospital billing office because there often is a reduced rate of financial assistance, charity care, other provisions available to deal with that bill, you know, beyond just dealing with the price that you get in the initial charge.
Right. Okay, well, Anthony Wright is the executive director of the health consumer advocacy group Health Access California. Anthony, thanks so much for speaking with me.
No, thank you.
Now let's turn to the arts. The San Joaquin Valley is home to a number of poets, past and present. Just yesterday, Juan Felipe Herrera, a former U.S. poet laureate, got a shout-out during Governor Gavin Newsom's inauguration. And earlier this month, Fresno City College professor Lee Herrick came out with his own new book of poetry. It's his first since he finished his tenure as Fresno's poet laureate. He spoke with me about how his book incorporates new themes for him, like gun violence, among familiar ideas, like adoption. Lee, thanks for being here with us. So we're here in part to talk about Scar and Flower, which is your third and latest book. Your previous book, Gardening Secrets of the Dead, came out in 2012. Can you talk a little bit about what's maybe different between that book and this one?
Sure. Well, Gardening Secrets of the Dead had a lot of poems in it about my adoption, about South Korea, about some political elements about the adoption community. But Scar and Flower, which I'm really excited about, is very different. I was writing a lot about violence and American gun violence specifically, some poems about suicide and trauma of that nature. And so the first half of Scar and Flower is comprised mainly of poems about that. And the second half of the book is more about how we survive that violence as an individual, as a community, and how we can hopefully persevere through some of those things.
I really wanted to talk about that, the gun violence thing that, as I was reading, came through quite clearly. And initially, the first section, which is entitled Scar, I was thinking, oh, because, you know, shootings and violence and death leaves a lot of emotional scars and physical scars. But then there continued to be these poems throughout the second portion entitled Flower. And I don't know, what led you to write those poems that, similar, I guess, to your second book, having a little bit of talking about politics of adoption, politics of different things? What led you to write about that?
You know, I don't know that I entered those poems with any specific intention. Honestly, for me, the best poems are the ones that call you out whether you want to write about them or not. And so, for example, in 2012... Sandy Hook. In 2014, Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri. 2016, the Orlando Club shooting. And so those events really moved me. There was a Korean adoptee who committed suicide in 2017 after being deported back to South Korea. One of my closest friends had an older brother who committed suicide. And so I just found myself writing in response to a lot of those things, and this book came out of it.
So you brought your book, Scar and Flower, and I understand you maybe picked one or two poems to read. Do you mind reading them?
I thought I'd read one that has to do with my adoption, and it's also sort of a poem about birth mothers or first mothers as well. And so this is called How Music Stays in the Body. Your body is a song called birth or first mother, a miracle that gave birth to another exquisite song. One song raises three boys with a white husband. One song fought an American war overseas. One song leapt from 14 stories high and like a dead bird shattered into the clouds. Most forgot the lyrics to their own bodies or decided to paint abstracts of mountains or moons in the shape of your face. I've been told mothers don't forget the body. I can't remember your face, the shape or story, or how you held me the day I was born, so I wrote 1,000 poems to survive. I want to sing with you in an open field, a simple room, or a quiet bar. I want to hear your opinions about angels. Truth is, angels drink too. Soju spilled on the halo, white wings sticky with gin, as if any mother could forget the music that left her. You should hear how loudly I sing now. I've become a ballad of wild dreams and coping mechanisms. I can breathe now through any fire. I imagine I got this from him or you, my earthly inheritance, your arms, your sigh, your heavy song. I know all the lyrics. I know all the blood. I know why angels howl into the moonlight.
Thank you. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Was there another poem that you wanted to read as well, or...
Sure, I'll try to change it up a little bit.
Is it similar?
Let's see, I'll read something that's a little different. This other poem I think I'll read called Flight, and it's in the second part of the book that has to do with how we cope and survive, and even maybe with a little bit of grace and joy. I think that's as important as anything. So this poem, Flight, is really just a poem about an airplane trip that I made to Oregon, and I started doing a crossword puzzle, but it had already been begun, and I just started imagining the people's lives who were traveling and the people we meet, and so it's called Flight. The in-flight magazine crossword partially done, a corner begun here, scratched out answers there, one set of answers in pencil, another in green. The woman with the green ballpoint knew the all-time hit king is Rose, and the Siem Reap treasure is Angkor Wat. The woman, perhaps en route to hold her dying mother's hand in Seattle, forgot about death for 10 minutes while remembering her husband's Cincinnati Reds hat while gardening after the diagnosis. Her handwriting was so clean. Maybe she was a surgeon. Maybe a painter. No. What painter wouldn't know 17 down, Diego's love, 5 letters? In a rush, her dying mother's voice came back to her. Or maybe she was a Chinese adoptee, and her first mother's imagined voice said, Wo ai ni. At 30,000 feet, you focus on 33 across, Asian American classic, The Woman. When a stranger in the window seat sees the clue and watches me write in W and whispers, Warrior. And for a moment you forget it is your favorite memoir, and she reminds you of lilies or roses, Van Gogh or stems with thorns, art galleries and romantic cities where she is headed, but you should not go. The flight attendant grazes my shoulder, and the crossword squares, the letters, the chairs and aisles seem so tight in flight, but there is nothing here but room, really. And maybe the next passenger will know what I do not. 64 down, 5 letters, purpose. And why do we remember what we do? We know the buzz of Dickinson's Fly and the number of years in Marquez's Solitude, but some things we will never know as it should be. Why the body sometimes rumbles like a plane hurtling over southern Oregon. How exactly we fall in love. Or if Frida and Maxine Hong Kingston would have loved the same kind of tea.
Wow, thank you so much for reading that. One thing I wanted to ask is you were the city's Fresno's Poet Laureate from 2015 to 2017, mm-hmm. and this is your first book since ending in that position. Do you feel like that changed how you wrote or, anything about your craft?
That's a good question. Being the Poet Laureate of Fresno was an incredible honor. You might know, or your listeners might know, of Fresno's incredibly deep and rich poetry tradition, so to be nominated and then appointed was pretty incredible. It did. I think that experience deepened my sense of not only Fresno, but some of the work and grit and perseverance that goes on here every day. So for example, I did a couple of readings at Valley State Prison, which was very intense and really one of the most rewarding reading experiences I've had. In Scar and Flower, there's a poem called Truths that I wrote for my induction ceremony at City Hall. There's a poem for Juan Felipe Herrera, who's a real inspiration and a friend to many people here, including me. So, yeah, it was a wonderful experience.
All right, well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. But we have been speaking with Lee Herrick, former Fresno Poet Laureate and a professor at Fresno City College. His latest book is Scar and Flower. It's published by Word Poetry Press. You can find it online on Amazon and the like. But Lee, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Finally, we continue our reporting on asylum seekers. The asylum process can take years in California, giving families released from detention plenty of time to settle in. As part of the statewide California Dream collaboration, KPCC's David Wagner checks in with one family attempting to start over in Los Angeles.
It's her day off from her job at El Pollo Loco, and Lizeth is cooking. We're only using her middle name because her asylum case is ongoing. She's stirring a big pot of beef soup.
Oh, caldo de res.
Lizeth sold food out of her home in Honduras, but she says gang members threatened her for refusing to pay extortion money known as a war tax. So she fled with her husband and two of her children, who are 6 and 14. They've been living in Los Angeles for more than 2 years, long enough to settle into a busy routine.
En la mañana, pues hay que levantarse temprano, a las 6.
They're up at 6, out the door by 7:20. Lizeth is at work by 8:30. Asylum seekers can't legally work when they first get here. It took Lizeth a year and a half to get her work permit. Her husband just got his. Now they can afford their own studio apartment in the San Fernando Valley.
Aquí, pues no nos gusta mucho porque la privacidad no está tan...
There's not much privacy, she says. A simple room divider separates the living area from the bedroom. It's small, but decked out with Christmas decorations. Lizeth says what they have is better than anything she imagined.
1000% mejor. Tengo esperanzas, tengo esperanzas, tengo sueños.
It's 1000% better. She says she has hopes, dreams, goals, and she knows she can achieve them in California.
En mi país uno se hace metas, se hace esperanzas, pero todo queda en sueños.
In her country, she says, you can have goals and hope, but everything remains a dream. 2 years may sound like a long time to wait for an asylum decision, but Lizeth's attorney, Jenna Gilbert, at Human Rights First, says the wait is normal.
It's oftentimes much longer than 2 years. 2 years is on the shorter end.
There are more than 140,000 immigration cases pending in California courts, about half of them in Los Angeles. As years go by, Gilbert worries that judges may start to think asylum seekers no longer have a credible fear of gang members in their home country. She says a claim that may have been strong a few years ago.
Maybe today isn't so strong. Things are changing so rapidly that there's really no way to provide your clients with any kind of comfort, any kind of understanding of what the road ahead might look like.
UC Hastings law professor Karen Musallo says some of that uncertainty comes from the Trump administration.
And certainly the administration is sending a message that people fleeing gangs or people fleeing domestic violence should not be recognized as refugees.
Even in cases, Musallo says, that have a strong legal basis for asylum. Gilbert now hopes for further delays.
Now that we're kind of at the halfway point, now I'm hoping that cases slow down as much as possible until we can see the end of this administration, hopefully.
Lizeth and her family grow more comfortable in California every day. They've put a down payment on a car, their kids are picking up English. Lizeth worries what would happen if they were deported back to Honduras.
Piensan que uno de aquí lleva mucho dinero.
She says people think families coming back from the United States have a lot of money. She's heard stories of people who went back to Honduras and didn't live for more than a month. But for now, she says the future is bright. In Honduras, holidays were hard. She could afford to give her kids gifts or a nice meal, but never both. This year, she'll make a big dinner. Her kids will have clothes, shoes, and a nice Christmas, like they haven't had in a long time. In Los Angeles, I'm David Wagner.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Laura Satsui, reporter Monica Velez, and our news director, Alice Daniel. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.